social system. That's the world we live in. And if you raise the question of reparations, it makes it necessary for African people to come to terms with this. So much is done against us all the time. Demoralizing black people. You took my money, you took my resources, you stole every damn thing we got. I want it.
Come, son. yesterday.
None other than Malcolm X in his autobiography. He talks about how he respected Mahalia Jackson and the fact that she could recruit so many people in the Nation of Islam, sort of adopted some of their fishing techniques when they would fish for new converts from Mahalia Jackson's methods. And on today's show, we have a very, very action-packed show, but before I talk about the show, I think I should thank two people, Omalia Shatella for giving me the space on Uhuru Radio, and Archie Shepp for giving me the concept of diasporic music. And Chairman Omalia Shatella gave me the spot on Uhuru Radio. And on today's show, we're going to be paying tribute to Roy Hamilton. Roy Hamilton, a great singer in the 50s and the 60s, who was a member of the Nation of Islam, and we will talk about that when we do our tribute to him. Also, we're going to conclude our interview with Abdullah Abdur Razak, who was Malcolm X's aide, and he's going to be talking about Manny Marable's book, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. And at 2:30, we're going to be speaking to Senator David Abdullah out of Trinidad and Tobago. And we're going to continue with the music of Garnet Silk.
Mama Africa, Mama Africa, am I coming home, hello Mama Africa, how are you, I'm feeling fine, and I hope you're fine too, hello Mama Africa, how are you, I hope when you hear these words, your grace turn blue, grace turn blue, I'm saying paradise. I'm coming soon. When I'm with you, I can't be wrong. If not in May, then you'll see me in June. Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I'm feeling fine, and I hope you're fine too. Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I hope when you hear these words, your face turn blue. Face turn blue. The sweet
You're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from the not-so-great white north. And we were listening to the music of Walde Semayat, a.k.a. Peter Tosh, a.k.a. Mr. McIntosh, Winston McIntosh, Peter Tosh. And he did Mama Africa, a song that he recorded with Sonny Okosun. And we also heard from the late, great Garnett Silk, and he did Hello, Mama Africa. And if you wanted to send us an email, you could do so by sending it to dj@uhururadio.com. And the Skype option, if you want to holler at us by Skype, you can just go to Uhuru Radio. And we're trying to get a hold of David Abdullah of Trinidad and Tobago, Senator David Abdullah. And right now we wanted to take you to Nigeria by way of Trinidad and Tobago and give you some music from Ella Ando.
Alanga la fila fiosu, alanga la fila fuyeye, alanga la fera kayere, oshunga la fila fuyeye.
Alanga la fila fiosu.
Alanga la fila fiosu, alanga la fila fuyeye, alanga.
You're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from the not-so-great White North here in Toronto, Canada. And we have been listening to the music of Ella Ando Oshun. She did a song called Oshun. And Ella Ando hails from the TNT, Trinidad and Tobago. And joining us on the line from Trinidad and Tobago is Senator David Abdullah. And first of all, I wanted to welcome you to the Uhuru Radio Network. And I guess I should let everybody know that you and I, we know each other and we go a long way back. And I wanted to congratulate you for the work that you have been doing on behalf of the workers and peasants of Trinidad and Tobago and all oppressed peoples around the world. So how are you doing?
Well, thank you very much for that very kind introduction. Yes, we go back a long way. I remember staying in your apartment. Oh, that was in 1992, I think it was.
Yes, sir.
So that's almost 20 years. Gosh, time flies. But it's good to be on your program. Thanks for having me.
I guess the first thing everybody wants to know is, what is the current situation in Trinidad and Tobago? And first of all, tell us a little bit about who is David Abdullah, Senator David Abdullah.
Well, I've been a political and labor activist, social activist for a long time now, since my student days at the University of the West Indies, St. Augustine campus here in Trinidad. And that was in the early 1970s. I contested the parliamentary seat of Tunapuna in 1976 for Labour Party, as it was at that time, the original United Labour Front. Didn't win that seat, but did credibly. And shortly after, joined the Premier Trade Union in Trinidad and Tobago, and I should say in the Speaking Caribbean, which is the Oilfields Workers Trade Union, as one of the educational research officers. I became head of that education department in 1978, and have been active in the union movement since then. I'm now general secretary of the union, as well as president of one of the two trade union federations in the country, the Federation of Independent Trade Unions and NGOs, FITUN. I'm chairman of the political party that represents workers in this country, the Movement for Social Justice. And through that, we are part of the current government of Trinidad and Tobago, which is a coalition government, a coalition of different parties and therefore of interest. And I sit in the Senate as well. So, you know, keeps me busy, you know, both on the political and labor fronts.
All right, you're listening to Uhuru Radio, and my name is Norman Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali. I'm speaking to Senator David Abdullah. And I received, you know, some information from Abdullah Kalimant, someone that both of us know. And he wanted me to contact you to talk about the current situation. I guess the things are heating up in TNT. Could you talk about what is taking place one day before Emancipation Day on the Twin Island?
Yes, well, yes, today, this is Emancipation Day weekend. Tomorrow, August 1st, is the in commemoration of Emancipation Day. It commemorates the end of slavery on the 1st of August, 1838. Of course, there was the abolition of slavery in 1834, and then there was a period of 4 years where the slaves were kept on the plantation in a so-called apprenticeship program. It really was a four-year period to enable the planter class, the slave-owning planter class, to make the adjustments of not having slave labor on the sugar plantations anymore. So August 1st is very important. And in the mid-1980s, the government made, or early 1980s rather, the government, after a long period of campaigning by groups here in Trinidad and Tobago, the government made the 1st of August, declared it Emancipation Day. So it is a day where primarily those Africans in our society, African descendants, they, you know, mobilize and have programs of education and so on and celebration. But it is also a time for the whole country, because emancipation is important not only for people who were descendants of the African slaves, but for everyone in the society, because it was the first major leap forward for freedom of ordinary people, of those who are oppressed and exploited at the time. So it's significant for all of us. But as we are talking, the country is at a high state of mobilization, not simply around emancipation, but more particularly on the trade union front, because the trade union movement has taken serious disagreement with the policy of the government to hold wages and salary increases down at a limit of about 5%. Now, the negotiations that we are currently in are for a previous period. It's for the 2008-2010 period, that three-year period, 2008-2009-2010. These negotiations ought to have been settled by the previous government, the Patrick Manning PNM government, but were not.
Excuse me, I don't want to cut you, but who, for the listeners, who is the current Prime Minister of Trinidad and Tobago today?
Right, from the 24th of May last year, when we had the elections, the Prime Minister is now Mrs. Kamla Prasad Bisesa, who leads the largest party in terms of numerical support within the coalition, that is the United National Congress, but is also the leader of the coalition, the People's Partnership Coalition, which is a coalition of five political parties: the United National Congress, the Congress of the People, the Tobago Organization of the People, the National Joint Action Committee, and my own party, the Movement for Social Justice. Those are the five parties in the coalition.
And, okay.
So these negotiations ought to have been settled by the previous government, because they would have been in that time of their responsibility, but they were not settled at the time. And so the current government, the People's Partnership government, had the responsibility and has the responsibility of settling the negotiations for virtually all the workers, in fact, all the workers in the public sector, not only public employees like the public officers, civil servants and so on, teachers, police officers, fire service officers, prison officers and so on, but all the negotiations in the state enterprise sector and the public utilities are also expired, and therefore, you know, we're trying to settle these negotiations. So in the oil industry, the Petroleum Company of Trinidad and Tobago, the National Petroleum Company, those are two major employers where the IT Workers Tribunal is a union representing the workers. The Electricity Commission, the Trinidad and Tobago Electricity Commission, the Power Generation Company, at the Water and Sewage Authority, the main public utility in water, all of these companies, University of the West Indies, there are very many negotiations that are outstanding at this time. And so the issue is, how do we resolve them? The government is maintaining that it requires a low-wage settlement because its current fiscal situation is not that strong, given the fact that the economic growth over the last 3 years has either been negative or flat. In 2009, we had negative economic growth, but we had flat growth in 2010, and very small growth is expected in 2011. And so the government is saying that it can't afford more than 5% salary increases. The unions are saying, on the other hand, we are saying as unions, that in the period 2008 to 2010, over those 3 years, we had a very high rate of inflation, averaging about 12% per year. So over the 3 years, we had a 35% inflation. And therefore, the real earning power of workers declined by 30 to 35%. And so 5% will certainly not cut it in terms of compensating workers for that serious decline in their earning power. So that is what the sticking point essentially is. Other matters have been discussed by the trade union movement with the government. last Tuesday, there was a 3.5-hour meeting between the Prime Minister and the heads of about 19 trade unions in the country. And there was significant consensus on many issues that the union leaders raised with respect to economic management, with respect to the need for constitutional reform, reform of labor laws and so on, a youth policy, proper land policy, agricultural policy. There was a lot of consensus on those issues because those were essentially matters that the current government, the partnership, put forward in its manifesto as areas where there would be major change. So those areas did not generate much conflict between the Prime Minister and the labor leaders. It really came down to the issue of how do we resolve these negotiations. The unions were saying they cannot accept the government imposing a wage ceiling because there is no policy on prices and profits. So you cannot have a try as a government to impose a wage policy in the absence of a policy on prices and profits. The Prime Minister conceded that there is no wage freeze or wage cap, but then went on to say that the negotiations should be restarted from ground zero. And the trade unions didn't accept that because in some cases there have been 40 negotiating meetings with the respective employers and so on. Because the government doesn't negotiate, it is the respective employers, the state enterprises and the management and boards of the utilities. They're the ones who negotiate with the unions. So the unions are saying, well, you know, we've gone through a process over several years. We've had 20 negotiating rounds. We've had 30, 40 negotiating rounds. Well, quite a bit has been settled. It doesn't make sense to reset the clock to zero and start that process all over again. But the Prime Minister felt that that is the way it should go. And so the talks between the Prime Minister and the trade union leaders broke down last Tuesday, and the unions are now mobilizing for a general strike.
Now, how has the press treated the current situation? Are you getting the international press? And how is the press in the Caribbean treating the issue? Is it being hushed up or, how much publicity has it received? I haven't seen too much in the international press. What about you?
Yeah, I'm not aware of a lot in the international press. There has been a lot in the local press, obviously, and in the regional press. The regional press would be, you know, covering it because Trinidad and Tobago's economy is the largest economy within the English-speaking Caribbean, within the Caribbean community, CARICOM, which is the economic and trade group that all the English-speaking independent countries of the Caribbean, together with Suriname and Haiti, belong to. And so clearly what happens to the economy of Trinidad and Tobago would impact significantly on the rest of CARICOM. The press has been covering all of the statements made by the trade unions. Of course, they have been hyping up the decision by the trade unions to have a general strike. No date has been set for that general strike, but they've been hyping that part up. I suppose that is sensational news, so that makes for good coverage. And they have also been covering the positions of the government, and there have been editorials, some of them calling for negotiated settlements or return to the table, some others, you know, more critical of the union movement, saying that a strike is not going to settle or resolve anything. But those editorials would be largely of that nature, given the fact that the newspaper ownership is closely aligned to some of the big local conglomerates, the large conglomerate firms within Trinidad and Tobago. Obviously, they would not want workers to take industrial action.
So it's the same as, I mean, the media, the corporate press, or the corporations run the media just like they do in any society. But I wanted to ask you this question. We know that the current Prime Minister of Trinidad and Tobago is a woman who is of Indian ancestry, and we also know that we have Africans and Indians in Guyana, Africans and Indians in Trinidad and Tobago. We have Africans and Indians in Uganda and Kenya. And I hold a view that it's always been the in the interest of imperialism to keep these two people fighting one another and to keep all working people fighting one another. Could you talk about the state of affairs between the Africans and Indians in Trinidad and Tobago?
Yes, you're right. In historical terms, colonialism and imperialism, you know, have worked at trying to set one ethnic group against the other, because the unity of working people, the unity of the working class, against you know, whether it be the old planter class or the transnational corporations, the multinationals that followed them, would not have been in their interest. So they used all kinds of techniques, including party politics, or principally party politics, in an effort to divide people, working people by race and by religion too. In the case of Trinidad, where you had divisions between the Muslims and the Hindus along political lines. I think that there's been a significant difference here in Trinidad and Tobago from even Guyana or some of those other countries that you mentioned, in that because of an independent progressive labor movement, we have seen workers taking action as a class, cutting across the lines of race and religion on many, many occasions in the past. And I think that has blunted any attempt, by capital to divide. But it's a constant tension in terms between our efforts to unite people as a class and, you know, the what happens at election time when the political parties make their appeals, some of which are not too subtle, to race and religion in terms of trying to show up support. Now, in 2010, what we saw with the coalition was the People's Partnership was a huge coming together, really a huge movement that cut across the ethnic lines very, very significantly, because the numbers of people who voted for the partnership were massive. And, you know, it was reflected in the fact that we won 29 of the 41 seats in the House of Representatives, in the Parliament, and, you know, really swamped the People's National Movement, whose core base really is essentially now amongst a section of the African population. So they're very limited in that regard. So the partnership got tremendous cross ethnic support, and there was a real hope that the partnership would have been able to forge a multiracial unity in the society in terms of nation building that would have enabled all of the resources, people resources of the country to be part of the process of building the country. I think that has eroded somewhat because the largest party in terms of seats in the parliament and so on, the United National Congress, that there have been elements, you know, that have wanted to pursue the old politics, not recognizing that really and truly the UNC by itself can't win an election, or if it does, it will be a very marginal victory at best. So, you know, there's a constant dynamic within the partnership in terms of how does one deal with governance going forward to ensure that every single citizen feels that they are part of the process and they're not being discriminated against. And that is going to be a continuing dynamic within the coalition, given the fact that there are elements within the UNC who come from the old tradition of ethnic politics. And that's a difficult culture for them to fully escape from.
We're speaking with David Abdullah, Senator David Abdullah of Trinidad and Tobago, and I wanted to go back to something. We talked about Emancipation Day, and we talked about 1834, 1834, in 1838. I believe the emancipation of the slaves, the ex-slaves in America was 1863. And when we talk about the slave trade and colonialism, we have to talk about Portuguese, the Portuguese, the Spanish, and the Dutch. Do you have those dates
in terms of the French?
I should really be punished for that. Yeah, the French or that. Ooh, that's yeah. They were top dog at one time. Yes, sir. Yeah. Could you talk about I sound like an idiot now, but yeah, the French, the Dutch.
Yeah.
I wanted you to talk about do you have the dates in terms of all of us have different dates, because of colonialism and imperialism, but the Spanish left Cuba. Do you have those dates? Off the top of your head,
I don't have all those dates off the top of my head.
Let's go back to the
Haitian Revolution.
Yes, sir. Right.
It was the first break of slavery, and that was the most important break historically because Toussaint Louverture and Dessalines and Christophe and the others were fighting while they were slaves. They fought as slaves to break not only slavery, but also to forge an independent nation of Haiti. And you know, that they got their independence in 1803.
Right.
1804. So, you know, 1803. So that preceded our ending of slavery in 1834, the abolition in 1834, and eventually full emancipation in 1838. So,
correct.
So the Haitian Revolution was very, very important, and I think one of the things that even the rest of the Caribbean does not do is to pay homage to the Haitian Revolution and the Haitian people in their, you know, tremendously important fights for independence and for their freedom. And they're paying for that up to now. I mean, the French imposed a debt on Haiti, which debt the French claimed was because France wanted to be given reparations for Haiti breaking slavery, breaking free of colonialism, and France wanted to be repaid for that economic loss which it suffered. You know, and that debt had to be paid for well over 100 years by the Haitian people.
Right.
And there's a call for France now to repay that debt in current dollars, of course, to the Haitian people, and therefore enable the Haitian people to get some of the resources which were stolen from it by France, and so on. So that, and the Haitian Revolution also served as a major light for the Latin American struggles, for Martí in Cuba and the other Cubans, Maceo and the others who were fighting for independence from Spain, and also for Simón Bolívar in Venezuela, and that whole process of Latin American independence from Spain. So, you know, I think pride of place has to go to the Haitians in their struggle against slavery. Because they defeated not only slavery, they defeated three of the most powerful imperial powers of the day, France, Spain, and Britain. And they defeated them militarily. Now that's just an amazing story.
And we're getting ready to close out. I wanted to say two things, and I wanted to ask you for your concluding remarks. But I think C.L.R. James wrote The Black Jacket is about the Haitian Revolution. I believe it was... He wrote that in 1938. And I remember visiting Savannah, Georgia, and I remember that Christophe participated in the American Revolution. I think he was 14. The Haitians, we must remind people in the United States that the Haitians actually fought alongside with the Americans. and helped
for good or for better or for worse,
Haitians helped America defeat the British. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, no, I mean, these historical links are so important, Norm, for current generations to appreciate. And yes, I highly recommend CLR's book, The Black Jackanapes, as a very important read. CLR, of course, Trinidad and Tobago born, was born in 1901. You know, my union, the Orchestra Orchestra Union, we were very close with Mello, and we put him up, you know, took care of him for a number of years in Trinidad. And he asked us to take responsibility for his funeral, which we did with great honor. And so, you know, I had quite a few, you know, discussions with him. The one was a fantastic, fantastic revolutionary mind. And so we need to encourage the current generations to read about those struggles and to use them as a guide for current action. I think right throughout the world, we are having major struggles for justice, as people do not accept the current order of neoliberalism. And we just have to pay attention and to what is happening and to express solidarity. And we appreciate, you know, your asking me to be on this program, because that's one thing of concrete solidarity, by sharing information across the continent, so to speak.
Let me say this last thing, that I spent a day with CLR James once in Washington, D.C. One day I will talk about it and write about it. It was a whole day of 21 years old, and I tried to, thought I could teach CLR James a few things or two, but I don't think I was able to get a word in edgewise. I mean, he destroyed me intellectually at the point, but... And the last thing I wanted to tell you is that I did find your Baron cassette tape, the singer, Byron, the sweet voice.
I missed that last piece, Tom. Yes, yes, sir.
Beg your pardon?
Could you just repeat the last thing? I missed
the last thing. No, I said, you heard the part about what?
Well, you're trying to teach CLR, but not so
far. When I said I will just look, this is a joke. I said I found your Baron tape. The last time you stayed here, you had a cassette tape of the sweet voice Baron, the singer from Trinidad.
Oh, Baron, the Californian.
Yes.
She has a voice. And Earl McLeod, who is the former president general of the Orchestra Trade Union, and now the minister of labor in the coalition government, is the political leader of our party, the MSJ. Errol, I think, taught Barrett in primary school very briefly many years ago.
All right.
Connections for societies like ours.
All right, sir. So thank you, and I really appreciate you coming on Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. We will be back in touch with you sooner than later.
Thanks a lot, Mom. You take good care. Good to hear from you.
All right. And we have been speaking with David Abdullah, Senator David Abdullah of Trinidad and Tobago, and Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio continues with our tribute to Roy Hamilton.
Hear that whistle, it's 10 o'clock.
Don't let go.
Come on, baby, it's time to rock.
Don't let go.
I'm so happy I got you here.
Don't let go, don't let go.
Keeps me grinning from ear to ear.
Don't let go.
Ooh, this feeling's killing me.
Oh, shucks.
Well, I won't stop for $1 million.
I love you so.
I just hold me tight and don't let go. Thunder, lightning, wind, and rain.
Don't let go, don't let go.
Love is bombing inside my brain.
Don't let go, don't let go.
I'm so eager, I'm nearly dying.
Don't let go, don't let go.
You've been keeping your lip from mine.
Don't let go,
yeah.
Don't let go.
Ooh, this feeling's killing me.
Oh, shucks.
Well, I won't stop for $1 million.
I love you so.
Just hold me tight and don't let go. Hound dog barking upside the hill.
Don't let go, don't let go.
The fist dragging him through the mill.
Don't let go,
yeah.
Don't let go.
If it wasn't for having you,
don't let go, don't let go.
I'd be barking and hollering too.
Don't let go,
yeah.
Don't let go.
This feeling's killing me.
Oh, shucks.
Well, I won't stop for $1 million.
I love you so.
Just hold me tight and don't let go. One day, baby, you'll quit me, yeah.
Don't let go,
I'll be crying and soaking wet.
Don't let go,
yeah. One thing, baby, I'll never stand.
Don't let go,
your lips kiss some other man.
Don't let go, don't let go.
Feeling's killing me, yeah. I won't stop for $1 million.
I love you so.
Just hold me tight.
Don't let go.
Just hold me tight.
Don't let go.
Hold me tight.
Don't let go.
Uhuru, you are listening to an abridged edition of Isaac Hayes' Don't Let Go. And we also heard from Roy Hamilton, who did the original rendition of Don't Let Go. And we are going, Isaac Hayes' rendition came out in 1973, I believe, and Isaac's came out in 1973, and Roy's came out in the 60s. But this portion of Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio is dedicated to Roy Hamilton. And Roy Hamilton was a young man who was born in Georgia in 1929, April 19th, 1929, and he passed away in New York in on July 20th, 1969. And Roy Hamilton was, I should say, Elvis Presley admired Roy Hamilton. And, of course, Jackie Wilson was really liked Roy Hamilton. But Roy Hamilton had a beautiful baritone voice. And Roy Hamilton was a member of the Nation of Islam. And Roy Hamilton was could not talk about being a member of the Nation of Islam, because we're talking about the 50s. And Malcolm X, I can't find the reference, but I remember Malcolm X talking about Roy Hamilton a lot. And I found out recently that Roy Hamilton was, he had joined, he got his ex in the 50s. And he was a member of the Mas number 7 in New York City. It had to be kept under wraps because at that particular time, he probably could not have worked had it came out that he was Roy X. But we're going to play another selection from Roy, two selections from Roy Hamilton, and come back and talk about Roy Hamilton, who supported the liberation of African people.
Darling, I hungered for your touch. Alone, lonely time. Time goes by so slowly, and time can do so much. Oh, you still man, I need love. I need your love. Godspeed your love to me. Lonely rivers flow to the sea, to the open arms of the sea. Lonely riverside, wait for me, I'll be coming home. Wait for me. Oh, darling, I hungered for your touch. A long, lonely time. Time goes by so slowly, and time can do so much. Oh, you still mad. I need your love. I need your love. Godspeed your love to me.
Though your dreams be tossed
Uhuru, you're listening to, I started to say CKLN, but this is not CKLN. This is Uhuru Radio, and this is Diasporic Music on the Uhuru Radio Network. And that was Roy Hamilton, and You'll Never Walk Alone. We're shining the spotlight on Roy Hamilton. And I remember when I was going to John C. Fremont High School, we had a young man by the name of Clarence Beaver Armstrong. And Clarence Beaver Armstrong used to sing that song. He played a great piano. And he also recorded with my group, Eminem and the Peanuts. And if we can find that song, maybe we'll have a chance to play I Found a Love by Eminem and the Peanuts. If we have it, Binga, if he can find it, we can play that. But right now we're paying tribute to Roy Hamilton. And Roy Hamilton was a boxer, and he gave up boxing because he could last longer and not get his brain scrambled. But he was a Golden Glove boxer, and he really stuck to singing. He also started off in the church at 3, 4, 5, something like that. But he was, like I say, he was in the movement. And there's a brother by the name of Ajib Bilal who's feeding me a lot of this good information. And we're going to be talking and writing more about Roy Hamilton. But this is a quote from Peter Guralnick's book, Dream Boogie, a book about the life of Sam Cooke, a 750-page book. But this is what Guralnick writes about Roy Hamilton. He says, Roy Hamilton had attended the march. That was the March on Washington, on his own, and was so inspired by it that he wrote to Corps National Director James Farmer, quote, I still feel that there is something more that I can personally contribute. Don't hesitate to call me, end of quote. But he didn't hear back from for almost 5 months, and then it was only from an assistant community relations director who suggested that he give her a ring so they can discuss just what he had might have in mind. Quote, we didn't count, end of quote, was a matter-of-fact assessment of Lloyd Price. Like Sam, an independent businessman and solid movement supporter. Talking about Lloyd Price. Now, Lloyd Price spent about 8 years living in Nigeria. He was also worked with Don King, and he was with Ali and when they went to Foreman and George Foreman and Muhammad Ali fought in the Zaire, now the Congo. Lloyd Price was there. So Lloyd Price says that they didn't really care about them. This is another quote from Lloyd Price. They wanted high-profile artists like Sammy, Harry Belafonte, Louis Armstrong, artists who appealed to whites and the black middle class, like Nat King Cole. But they could have been they could have been more high profile, but who could have been more high profile than rock and roll singers selling millions of records and playing interracial music and interracial dances? And end of quote. That was from Peter Guralnick's book. And right now we wanted to hear two selections from Lloyd Price.
The night was clear and the moon was yellow and the leaves came tumbling down.
give my love to you over and over. What more can I do? Over and over, my friend says I'm a fool. But over, over, over and over, I'll be a fool for you. 'Cause you've got
personality,
walk
with personality,
talk
with personality.
You're listening to Diasporic Music on the Uhuru Radio Network. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada. And we were listening to the music of Lloyd Price. Lloyd Price, originally from New Orleans, Louisiana, who made a big mark in the 50s. He also lived in Africa, lived in Nigeria for 8 years, and he worked with Don King. He was in Zaire when the Rumble in the Jungle took place, and if you see the film about the fight, Lloyd Price is a very articulate man. He's getting ready to take his life story to Broadway. And we are paying tribute to Roy Hamilton, the late great Roy Hamilton, who joined the Ancestors in 1969. And Roy Hamilton was a member of the Nation of Islam, and he refused to tour for the State Department because of his beliefs. He could not tour for the State Department because he was a Muslim and he did not like the way African people were treated in America and around the world. So he thought it would be a contradiction for him to tour for the State Department. But he was big enough to have done that, but he refused. And we're getting ready to listen to him sing a song called Hurt, and then we're going to hear Gerald Alston and Blue Lovett and the Manhattans sing the same song.
Said your love was true, and we'd never part. Now you want someone new, and it breaks my heart. I'm hurt much more than you'll ever know. Still love you so, but even though you hurt me like no one else could do, I would never.
Say Saturday Morning Live, but this is Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and that was the Manhattan's rendition of Hurt, and we also heard Roy Hamilton, who we have been paying tribute to, Roy Hamilton, who joined the Ancestors way back in 1969, and he has really been overlooked by the music industry, and he influenced Elvis, was a big admirer of him, and you can definitely hear how Jackie Wilson was influenced by him. But we will be talking about Roy Hamilton and play some more of his music. But right now, we wanted to play Eminem and the Peanuts, a group that I sang in, and I was talking earlier about Clarence Beaver Armstrong, and he used to sing Roy Hamilton songs when we were in high school, and we were in the Glee Club together. But he sang lead on one of our songs, but this is Eminem and the Peanuts from Fremont High School and Manual Arts High School. But Clarence is playing on this session, but he is not singing. This is Eminem and the Peanuts.
The Organization of Afro-American Unity.
Uhuru, you're listening to you're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and that was Eminem and the Peanuts, Pat White, Still in the Land of the Living, Willie Malone, Don Malone, who is no longer with us, and Tommy DeRoe, who is no longer with us, and myself. And Clarence Armstrong was on that session. Clarence Armstrong was a young man who went to school with me. We sang together in the Glee Club, and he helped write and produce a lot of our musics. But right now, we're going to end Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. We're going to conclude with an interview with Abdur Razak, who was Malcolm X's personal aide. And this is an interview where he talks about Manning Marable's book, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. He also talks about his relationship with Malcolm X. And this is Abdur Razak.
The Muslim, the Organization of Afro-American Unity was to be a non-religious organization, a political organization.
That's my understanding.
Yeah, that's it. But see, when you use terms like that, everybody got a different interpretation. One time the OAAU was meeting, and somebody said the meeting should start with a prayer. And Lynn Chiflet said, no, we don't pray here. And a woman jumped up. She said, what? You don't pray? You see, when you start dealing with Negroes, when you start talking about you don't believe in God or you don't pray, you walking on very shaky ground. So you had this confusion. Now, you had a lot of people from the Muslim mosque was all also members of the OAAU, but they were not officials. And a lot of times there were things that had to be done that only the brothers in the Muslim mosque knew how to do. The brothers from the OAAU didn't know how, like the stand post, the post of God, and things that I made. They just didn't know how to do it. Sometimes we spoke. Benjamin was with the Muslim mosque, but he was an accomplished speaker. So he often spoke for the OAAU. So it was confusing. And I was wearing like three or four different hats. I was captain of the men in the Muslim mosque. I was Malcolm's secretary. I ran the office. I worked for Shawabi as a secretary so I could get international phone calls from Malcolm and get directions in what to do. And yet, when something was to be printed up for the OAAU, people there didn't know how to do it. So I know a guy who had a mimeograph machine called a Gestetner. Gestetner was a fantastic machine. It was the best mimeograph machine on the market. I guess it was made in Germany.
The Gestetner, I remember that. So yeah, but go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, then, after the Gestetner, the printing industry came out with what is called a paper plate, photo offset. Up until then, whenever you wanted something photo offset, you had to have the copy ready for the camera, and it was printed on a metal plate, and you had to have a run, say, of 5,000 to justify the cost of the plate and getting the copy ready for the camera. But then someone came out with a paper plate, and it became economically justifiable to produce 200, 250 copies. But the paper plate was not good for, say, more than 500 copies because it wore out or something like that. Anyway, I found a guy who could do this. So even with the aims and objectives of the OAAU, man, they came out so shoddy. Malcolm was highly incensed. But you see, Malcolm had a different way of dealing with people who had not been in the nation. He handled them with kid gloves. So I had to have that done, too. I had to get a guy who ran a music publishing company, and there was a thing called Art Type where you could print up the type by taking a stylus and rubbing down on something, and it looked perfect. You didn't have to use a photo offset. You didn't have to use I forgot what they call it. You had all of these different fonts, and you typed in a machine, typograph or something. Anyway, that thing got...
But we're talking like a lot of people, like we're talking ancient history. It's like when some people talk about a 45, they think that you might be talking about a pistol as opposed to a record, you know. But
That's right. This even when I say Gestetner, you're the first person I spoke to who even knew what Gestetner meant.
I was in the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, and we used to print with the Gestetner. I mean, you know, we used to do, well, in Detroit, we used the Gestetner, and we would print up flyers and pass them out in front of the plants in the mornings, right? So I know a little bit about that, right?
Well, nobody else I know ever heard of the Gestetner. I was the Cadillac of mimeograph machines, you see?
Right.
Anyway, I forgot my point now, but any event...
We're talking about the difficulties of dealing with the OAAU and the Muslim Mosque Incorporated and Lynn Schiffner. I think she was from Los Angeles, I believe, right?
Los Angeles. She was a highly capable person. See another thing that a lot of people don't want to acknowledge, or they magnify it. In the nation, there was two separate nations. There was the nation of men and the nation of women. There was the Fruit of Islam, which was the men, And there was the MGT, the Muslim Girls Training and General Civilization class, which was the women. Well, the men had a captain over them in every mosque, and over the entire nation, the supreme captain of the FOI, Raymond Sharif. Well, the sisters had a captain too, the sister captain. She was the captain of the MGT.
And was that Elijah Muhammad's daughter?
Elijah Muhammad's daughter was the supreme captain of the MGT.
And she was married to Raymond Sharif, if I'm not
correct. Married to Raymond Sharif, who was the supreme captain of the FOI.
Right.
And their son was the circulation manager of the Muhammad Speaks newspaper.
That was her son?
That was her son, Hassan. And,
right.
And her sister, Lottie, was the captain of the MGT at mosque number two. And her brother was the assistant supreme captain of the FOI. So everybody in Chicago was in the Muhammad family with the exception of John Ali.
Right.
John Ali was the only official that was not a member of the Muhammad family. And that led to a whole bunch of stuff that nobody can clearly understand because they don't know anything about the nation. And I told this to Manning Marable. He said, I know an awful lot. And I said, yeah. I said, but let me tell you something. Most of the speaking that I do is trying to correct distortions of people who thought they knew so much. Because most of the knowledge that people think they have is misknowledge. Anyway.
You were talking about the book now. I don't want to distract you, but
will be
devoted
to the precision of your question. I'm an old
now,
man.
John Ali is a real controversial human being. John Ali, there was a book by Carl Evans, The Judas Factor, and then there was another book by Zach Kondo, The Assassination of Malcolm X, and then Bill Sayles did a book from Civil Rights to Black Liberation on the Organization of Afro-American Unity. And I know that many... I don't know. I want to be precise. I don't know if Zach Kondo or Bill Sayles, but Carl Evans claims, and many people claim, that John Ali was working for the other side. And he was definitely fighting. He fought against Malcolm, I guess, and he and Malcolm at one time were roommates, I believe.
They were. They were housemates, not roommates.
Housemates, right. That, yeah.
Another term that I don't like that Manning Marable uses. He speaks of a brother and saying, we were roommates. We were not roommates. I had a duplex apartment. He was a tenant, and we were brothers. But they use the term years ago. I guess roommate didn't mean the same thing. But now roommates mean there's something splivvy vivvy going on. You know, when you say two men are roommates, that's like they living in the same room. We were not living in the same room, and John Ali and Brother Malcolm were not living in the same room.
Right, yeah, right.
I think shared a kitchen, but I'm not sure. But
right.
Minnie, who was John, his name was John Morris? Simmons, John Simmons, John 11X Simmons. His wife Minnie and Brother Malcolm's wife apparently didn't get along. I wasn't there, so I'm telling you what the literature says. And Brother Malcolm got John put in the position of the national secretary.
National secretary, not secretary of number seven, but over the whole Nation of Islam.
He was the secretary at Nation at mass number seven.
Right.
But he was promoted and became the national secretary, the secretary of secretaries. So like the mafia says, the capo of the capo rey, the captain of all captains, the secretary of all secretaries.
Right.
Now, let me say this in defense of John Ali. If you focus upon John Ali and think that he was the agent, first place, there were no black FBI agents in the United States. There was a man from Aubrey Lewis who came up to me November the 24th, 1964, and said, my name is Aubrey Lewis. I'm with the Bureau. And I said, Bureau of what? He said, the Bureau. I said, what you want me to do, handsprings? And he was the first FBI agent descended from slaves in America.
I don't want to cut you, but I thought that J. Edgar Hoover had put black FBI agents when Garvey came along with. That's not true.
They were not agents; they were informants.
There's a difference. Okay.
You got to make a difference between an informant and an agent. There was thousands of informants. Even John Ali took FBI training, according to Brother Malcolm, but he didn't go to Quantico, so he never became an agent. You understand that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now, Louis Lomax, in his book, When the Word is Given, specified or hinted that John Ali was an FBI agent.
That's correct.
Yeah, and other people picked up. This is what happens with what I say. So many distortions have crept in because instead of people doing their original research, they went to somebody who misresearched and took their distortion and magnified it. I'm going to give you a perfect example. A woman from Romania or Bulgaria someplace was talking about Malcolm having preceded Mr. Muhammad to Mecca. And Malcolm didn't precede Mr. Muhammad to Mecca in 1959. He got as far as Jeddah. But he did not go. But a reporter came and asked the brother, well, where's Brother Malcolm now? He said, oh, he's in Mecca by now, because he expected him to go to Mecca, but Malcolm stopped. And the press picked this up. So now people got Brother Malcolm is going to Mecca, and he did. And he told me he didn't go to Mecca. He only went to Jeddah. The same thing with when he went there and saw, he saw Nasser, meaning he saw him with his eyes. But the word to see can also mean to meet. And they got that confused. He saw Sadat, but...
We need to clarify the fact that at that time, and when he met with Sadat, there was no Egypt. It was three countries, I think: Egypt, and
somebody else.
Lebanon, maybe.
I don't know.
And they were three, like a pan Arab, like Nkrumah and Sekou Touré and Lumumba and Modibo Keita, Mali, Guinea. Ghana and Congo was trying to do, but they actually did that in reality. But yeah, Mr. Muhammad went to Malcolm went before Mr. Muhammad to the Middle East, right?
Yeah.
In 1958. But he didn't make it to Mecca. He made it to Jeddah, which I guess is not. Mecca and Medina are supposedly the top of the line cities or holy cities, right?
Well, I wouldn't answer that because I know he said Medina was even more peaceful than Mecca.
Right.
This was his second trip when he went and made Hajj. But Mr. Muhammad wanted to make Hajj, but J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI called the State Department and told the State Department to hold his passport, so he couldn't make Hajj. So he made Umrah, which is the same ritual, but not at the time of Hajj. J. Edgar Hoover did that. And I got the letters. I copied them from the show.
Okay, now, I'm a man of my word, and I know you're a man of your word. So we said, you said you were going to give me an hour, so that means we have about 10 minutes left, since we started at 8:08. And I wanted to ask you, the last days of Malcolm, I saw a film, I was watching a film last night, which I never even watched it, done in 1981 with Morgan Freeman, who played Malcolm. He didn't use his name. But in that film was Yuri Kochiyama, Afi Davis, and Amiri Baraka. Could you talk about the assassination of Malcolm and the fact that supposedly the people are still supposed to be alive according to Manning Marable? Is that do you hold any
truth to what Manny Marable put forth in his book.
What are you speaking from?
No, I'm saying that, okay, Zach Kondo and Carl Evans identified the people that were supposed, that one person was on the scene, Tomage Hare, was actually apprehended at the scene, and he was convicted, and he pointed the finger at two other guys who supposedly were not there, and apparently...
He never pointed the finger at those two brothers who were not there. He said that they were not there.
He said they were not there, but I'm saying he never said they were there. No, I did not mean, if I said that, I didn't mean to say that. Apparently, someone has identified the people who actually assassinated Minister Malcolm are still supposed to be alive, and that is, Manny Marable talks about that in his book.
Manny Marable and a fellow named Abdurrahman Muhammad, Zach Kondo, a fellow named Cheeks, whose father was, I understand, the president of Howard University. Manning Marable, Abdurrahman Muhammad, Zach Kondo, this Cheeks fellow, and someone else called me and asked me to be on a conference call saying that a man named William Bradley,
right,
also known as Mustafa Shabazz of Newark, who was married to a woman who has a boxing gymnasium, that they had a film of him outside the Audubon Ballroom beating on or taking something from Talbench Hare. And therefore, they knew that he was involved in the murder of Brother Malcolm. So I said, well, if you have pictures of him outside the Audubon Ballroom, do you have anything on of him inside the Audubon Ballroom? And they said, no. So I said, well, do you have a lawyer? Because the same name came up with William Kunstler, who was one of the best criminal lawyers in the United States. And I said, he's one of the four names that were given by Talmadge Hare, and nothing ever came of it. So what makes you think that y'all are going to be successful? Well, don't you want us to be successful? I said, I want anybody who was involved in the murder of this great man to pay the price for it. I said, I merely asked you a question. You said that he was outside of the Audubon Ballroom, and Malcolm was not killed outside the Audubon Ballroom. He was killed inside the Audubon Ballroom, and it would help your case if you had some evidence that he was in the Audubon Ballroom. So they got, like, annoyed with me, and I got angry, and I told them, I said, you know, the present-day Negro or colored intellectual is no less a liar and a cunning thief than his illustrious teacher. And I went up to tell him, I said, all of y'all are interested in Manning Marable, you want to sell your book, Abdurrahman Muhammad, you want to become the chairman of the Black Studies Department at some university. That's all y'all are interested in. I said, the proof of which is there are two brothers who have spent over 40 years in jail, and y'all know he was not in the Audubon Ballroom, and you ain't said or done jack smack. I said, J. Edgar Hoover, who has a history, he got Marcus Garvey exiled. His FBI was involved in the murder of Fred Hampton. And there's microfilm, 10 rolls of microfilm, how this dog did. He set up a COINTEL program. The Scientologist broke into the FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania, where J. Edgar Hoover set up a COINTEL program. He said, we want these people to think that there's an FBI agent behind every mailbox. And none of y'all are saying anything about J. Edgar Hoover. You're concentrating on the finger that pulled the trigger and not on the brain that planned it. So I never heard from him after that. I never heard from Manning Marable after that. I never heard from, I did hear from Abdurrahman Muhammad once. and that's the story. So, and I still feel that way. Nobody, all of the great lawyers we have and whatnot, nobody has accosted the Federal Bureau of Information. You have that little dog, J. Edgar Hoover, saying, we are only an investigative agency. Then why did he contact the State Department and tell them to pull Mr. Muhammad's passport? Is that investigation? Why did he tell certain reporters to print things in the newspaper that were untrue about Brother Malcolm? Why did he tell reporters, and I'm telling you what I have copies of on letterhead memorandums from the Federal Bureau of Investigation. where he told them, yes, I have them. I have them right in this house. I hope it don't get blown up tonight. he says, write these letters and do not put them on a LHM, which means letterhead memorandum, and mail them from places so that they will not be able to tell that they came from the FBI. This is the same dog who, when Emmett Till got killed and people accusted the FBI for not protecting him, he said the FBI is not a protective agency. We're a purely investigative agency. Is that investigating, telling people to print crap that is not true to cause the fission between Malcolm and Mr. Muhammad?
Now, Max Stanford, Muhammad Ahmed was close to Malcolm, and Max Stanford, Akbar Muhammad Ahmed, Maxwell Stanford Jr., was, I guess he was, him and Herman Ferguson, they were implicated in the plot to blow up the Statue of Liberty and so on and so forth. But he,
Herman Ferguson was not implicated in this plot to blow up the Statue of Liberty. Neither was Max Stanford.
Why was Max Stanford, wasn't Max Stanford involved, not involved, but didn't they have him hooked up with people up in Montreal? And I thought it was supposedly the Revolutionary Action Movement who J. Edgar Hoover called Max Stanford the most dangerous man in America at one point.
Okay, well, then I stand corrected. But the people that I know that were involved were Khalil Syed, little judo professor, played the trumpet. I could see the guy. Some guy named Colin,
Colin,
FBI
right.
informant, and somebody in Canada. So maybe Max was involved, but I didn't see. The reason why I speak with such force on this is these people were meeting in my house. what is the guy? He's a black belt in judo. Man, I'm looking at the guy. I can't tell his name. I'm getting set up. But anyway, I didn't know that Max Stanford, but I retract what I said because it was a statement made out of ignorance. I did not know Max was a Walter Bow.
Walter Bow, right, Walter Bow. He was supposed to be an agent, right?
Huh?
Was Walter Bow the guy that turned out to be working with the other side?
Brother Jalali. Brother, they say I was an agent. I look at my FBI file. They wouldn't even interview me. They said because this guy responds so vociferously, it don't pay to even interview him. Look, they had thousands of FBI. Brother, listen. Do you know anything about Denmark Vesey, Nat Turner, Gabriel Prosser, Tuasavan Overture? Do you know what it meant to this country to have a man descended from slaves going all over the world who met 11 heads of state in Africa, going to the Bandung Conference, going to Algeria? Do you know the fear? Do you? Man, let me shut up. I feel like I'm lost in the friggin' wilderness, man. Nobody seems to want to entertain the enormity. Here's a guy who was in Charleston, South Carolina, planning to murder all the white people there.
You're talking about Denmark Vesey?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They hung him, right?
That's right.
Nat Turner. Now, here you got a man comes out of prison, gets involved with the Nation of Islam, and starts going all over the
world,
telling people actually what's going on in this country that is calling itself the citadel of democracy, and telling the African countries, look, you being doo-dooed on by the same person who pulled his pants down and crapped on us. And now you got an organization of African unity, and yet there's more people descended from Africa in the United States than there are in any single country in Africa with the exception of Nigeria.
Right.
And you act like we don't exist. And then he went to the Muslim world. He said, what is this crap y'all talking about? Islam being for all people and we being doo-dooed on in America and you are not raising a hand to do anything about it. And many of us are Muslims and some of you don't want to accept us as Muslims because we ain't riding camels. That doesn't make any kind of sense. You're supposed to be for humanity. We're human beings. And y'all was involved in the slave trade, too. So don't give me no crap y'all know how with this.
Right.
So now here he got two great blocks, 43 independent nations in the General Assembly of the United Nations, all of these countries in the World Muslim League, Hajj going on, all of them. And what did Mr. Mohammed, this is another thing, man, I got to tell you this. Manning Marable describes the blackboard in the Nation of Islam as having the crescent versus the cross, mm-hmm. and a sign saying which one will survive the War of Armageddon. But he left out the most salient piece. Under the cross, they had a black man hanging from a tree. Mention that. So what was his game? I mean, he kind of said, well, in any event, when America wanted to be free from England, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to sever the political bands, for example, well, who do they send? They send Benjamin Franklin to find one country who would accept us as a country. And what country was that?
So Liberia?
No, it was France.
France. What am I talking about? You're France.
Was the first country to recognize the United States. And to this day, England and France hate one another. Of course, France recognized and accepted us as a free country, America.
Accepted America. Yeah. I threw me off the American part, right? Yeah.
I hear a man running all over the world and going to elevate our struggle from a civil rights struggle to a human rights struggle so that the United States can be taken to world court and tried and judged and exposed. She calls herself a free enterprise system and got the largest contingent of slaves in the history of the modern world. She says she's a democracy, and yet she has counties in the South that got more blacks in it than they got whites, but they don't allow them to vote. They gerrymander in the North. Come on. And you think that, as Malcolm used to say, a tabby cat in the kitchen is more dangerous than a tiger in the backyard. And they realized this. So they killed him. They had no choice. They couldn't deport him like they did Marcus Garvey. But they had to kill him.
They killed him, then they killed Martin, then they killed Fred Hampton, then they killed Bunchy Carter. Yeah, I mean, it just goes on and on and on in terms of Medgar Evers. Well, I guess they killed Medgar before they killed Malcolm.
Thank you. And nobody wants to admit this. Everybody wants to let me draw. I shouldn't even do this because I put myself in danger, but I'm going to say it. What did they do to Bin Laden?
They killed him and dropped his body. I mean, they didn't give him a trial.
Did they try him? No.
No, sir. They just killed him.
What did the state of Israel do to Eichmann?
Okay.
They sent people out after him. They captured him. They put him in a plane. They carried him to Israel, and they tried him.
That's right.
Of law, and found him guilty.
They didn't do the same thing to Bin Laden. They just killed him and dumped his body in the ocean.
No. So this is a country, the Native American said he speaks with a forked tongue. He's like a friggin' snake. His tongue is split at the edge, and he says one thing and he means something entirely different. Now, how are we supposed to fare in a country like this that don't even tell the truth about us, don't tell the truth about them, don't tell the truth about what they did to us and are doing to us? Oh, anyway.
Is there anything else you would like to add? Because you've given me
Malcolm was not a misogynist, and there's nothing that Malcolm ever did, thought, said in my presence to lead you to think that he had a drop of homo.